Washington Post Live's Futurist Summit, The New Age of Tech, is presented by Mozilla.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Good morning. Welcome to this event. My name is Leanne Caldwell. I am an anchor at Washington Post Live and also co-author of the Early 202 newsletter. Today, we are joined by Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, and Senator Todd Young, Republican from Indiana, to talk about all things tech, AI, TikTok, of course. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Almost a standing ovation.
That's right. Yeah.
Maybe after you're done speaking, you'll get the standing ovation. So let's start with TikTok. This is obviously a big item in the news lately. As you both know, the House passed a bill last week that would force the divestment of TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, within 6 months or threaten it be banned in the United States. Senator Warner, I want to start with you. Yesterday, there was a classified briefing for a couple committees on Capitol Hill. You have said that you are supportive of this House bill to divest, to force the divestment. I want to ask you, though, a lot of this information talking about the national security risks of TikTok have been kept secret because the information is classified. Do you believe that that information should be declassified because there are 170 million users on TikTok who don't perhaps know why there's even talk of a ban or challenges with it?
Well, first of all, Leanne, thank you for having me. It's great Todd and I are here again. We've done a couple of these tech settings together. Let me step back. I mean, I started on this effort over a year ago, and we had a more comprehensive approach that didn't look just at TikTok or social media, but looked at tech companies coming from China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, because we don't really have a legal framework to address those. We kind of do a whack-a-mole approach. We look at TikTok, or we look at Huawei, or the Russian company Kaspersky a number of years back. And we were merrily moving along. We had 26 bipartisan co-sponsors, the Biden administration supportive. And to your point, because maybe we hadn't made enough of a public case, TikTok, which has enormous power, dropped close to $100 million, both lobbying and I think they sponsored every political tip sheet literally for weeks and hired everybody in town, and we got attacked from the far left and the far right. Why this is important, and yes, short answer is yes, we should try to declassify as much information. But remember, this is not simply an American issue. Canada, the UK, the Europeans, Australia, New Zealand have all banned TikTok from government phones because of national security in their interest. India has banned it from consumer use. And if we were to sit back, one senator said yesterday, I thought it was good, if there wasn't a TikTok and we're going to suddenly make the premise that we're going to have China come in because Chinese law dictates, as of 2017, that every Chinese company has to be first and foremost loyal to the Communist Party, not to shareholders or to customers. But if we were to create an entity and say, we're going to have 170 million Americans on an application 90 minutes a day, and we're going to allow China to basically hoover up all of the data that comes out from that interaction, and at the same time allow this 170 million Americans 90 minutes a day, a slight shift in that algorithm can mean the content that you're seeing, and that's the genius of TikTok's algorithm, is it kind of knows what you like before what you know, is that that can be slightly shifted, and you've suddenly got the most powerful propaganda tool potentially ever. And that notion, we would say, of course we will never let that happen. But that's where we are, and while I think the briefing was great yesterday, and the Energy and Commerce Committee, after they got the briefing in the House, voted 50 to nothing to take this action, 352 votes ultimately in the House. But the basic facts of there's been no rebuttal that the Chinese Communist Party does not have access to this data or the ability to manipulate the information that Americans receive.
And Senator Young, I'm going to get to you in 1 second, yeah. But I have a follow-up, and that is, what is the concern? Is it the fact that China has access to all this data? All these companies, so many companies have access to Americans' data. It's a part of our daily lives. or is it the ability to manipulate what Americans see through the algorithm?
Well, first of all, and Todd and I were talking backstage, I think we need something that looks at social media in a broader sense. We've been awful. We have a batting average of zero on that. But there is something uniquely challenging about TikTok, is ultimately, if this information is turned over to the Chinese espionage services that could be then potentially used for nefarious purposes, that's not a good thing for America's long-term national security interest. If you can slightly, particularly in an election year like this, if TikTok was to shift the algorithm and suddenly messages that say Taiwan really is part of China, or Putin really should have Ukraine, that is not in America's national security interest. And the difference between that and Facebook and Google's and others is that, end of the day, they are not controlled by the Chinese government. And the one thing I think was, one of the misnomers that people talk about sales, and I'm glad to see there's already interest from groups that would potentially purchase, about 35-40% roughly of the ByteDance ownership, because that is, ByteDance is a Chinese company, has actually got major American investors in it. So those investors could roll over. End of the day, all we want is, it could be an American company, it could be a British company, it could be a Brazilian company. It just needs not to be from one of the nation states, China being one of the four that are actually named in American law as adversarial nations.
Senator Young, you seem a little bit more skeptical about this House bill. Correct me if I'm wrong, but are you supportive of divestment? And if not, what should be done, if anything?
And that may be informed by some interaction we've had in the hallway and what have you. I will say the briefings we received concern me, I think, as much as my colleague here, who's so thoughtful on these issues and has a bill on this topic. And I'm persuaded that we need to take up one of the three bills that is most discussed in this area, all of which in various forms propose a throttling back or a divestment of TikTok. And I think we are going to have to take some sort of action. Maybe it's supporting one of these three bills. So let me step back. Though I have not authored a bill on this particular topic, I've been deeply involved for several years running now in this effort to harden ourselves against a country, China, that has weaponized our economic interdependence in various ways. Sometimes that's by threatening to cut off their market for particular products from the United States or from our Asia-Pacific allies if they're unhappy with an utterance of one of their leaders. Sometimes that's dumping particular products into the United States in order to exercise market control in that particular sector. One could envision here in the on the information superhighway, as we used to call it, right, in the information economy, the throttling back of particular coverage of different incidents, of directing a company like TikTok to manipulate their algorithm in certain ways that was advantageous to the reputation or interests of the Chinese Communist Party. One could envision the request for data by the Chinese Communist Party that had been gathered on American citizens. That's a vulnerability. And the unfortunate thing about this is Congress and the American people weren't fully acclimated to the threats posed by the CCP and all the various vectors through which they could threaten the interests of the American people as many of these companies emerged. So, could there be some measure of consumer harm associated with the transition either to other ownership or another platform? I acknowledge there could be. Okay. And so what we're attempting to do, I think, is to identify, muddle through, and come up with rules of the road for not just here and now, but for the future, so that we can continue to do business with China as we will, and we can continue to function in this complicated world in which we have a geopolitical adversary, just to be plain about it, that is also a major, major economic partner. And will continue to do so on a going forward basis. So that's what I aim to get out of this effort. I do think we're going to have to take some action, some bold action. What precisely that looks like is maybe subject to some modification.
And let me just add two quick things. Yeah. One, I think Todd and I both believe, you know, China's a great nation, and Chinese people are great people. I have no, and particularly sometimes this shouldn't shift into bias against the Chinese diaspora. But the CCP is an adversary that is tough, authoritarian, and literally is competing with us in technology domain after technology domain in an unprecedented way. And if we don't have a framework, for those of us on the Intel Committee, we were starting to wave the flag actually under President Trump, and we were a little late getting there, but he did get there, like on Huawei. And the fact that we didn't make that clear early enough in a more forceful way, we're now spending federal taxpayer dollars to rip out Huawei equipment that had been purchased. And we are trying to counter Huawei in a kind of, frankly, with the balance of democracies around the world. So this, we've seen this movie before. It's just in the case of TikTok, and it's very popular. We get it. We want that creativity and social influencers to be able to continue. But you've also seen their heavy-handed kind of lobbying tactics, I think actually in the House, blew up in their face, and that's why 352 votes in favor of the bill.
Moreover, I would also say there are dimensions to social media that are unique to that realm, right? So we're not just dealing with a commercial actor in ByteDance. We're dealing with the public square. I have four children. And I will freely admit that they spend time in their bedrooms, like all their friends, on TikTok from time to time, okay? And if they're not on TikTok, they have no idea what's happening on TikTok and are unable to communicate with their cohort, okay? So I do understand how that platform can shape the impressions, the awareness of the different things, and even the political views of people. And if weaponized, that could be dangerous. So this is a potential vulnerability to the American people. It's our job to protect the American people against potential vulnerabilities.
Sticking with China, but moving on to a different topic, artificial intelligence. Is there, Senator Young, is the U.S. behind on AI as compared to China? And is this a, what does the U.S. need to do specifically to catch up?
It's not my assessment that we're behind China. In fact, it's my assessment based on consultation with all kinds of experts, governmental, commercial, researchers, that we are ahead. But that's an imprecise estimate. Mm-hmm. You know, I've gathered my data points in recent months as I've studied this issue, working with many of my colleagues. So I have proposed legislation along with Senator Bennett to actually establish an office over at Commerce. It's analogous to the Office of Net Assessment, where we would, on an ongoing, Warner's a co-sponsor, characteristically, I mean, he has related legislation actually on standards that I think needs to be passed. But we need to be able to answer that with some measure of precision and authority and so forth. That's going to require analysts to focus on nothing but that moving forward. But with that said, what do we need to do to ensure that we stay ahead? Well, what we're hearing from the development community is as much as anyone else is, let us do what we do well, continue to invest in way upstream research through our DOE labs, through the National Science Foundation and other research entities. Make sure that when we have challenges or opportunities, meaning those who develop artificial intelligence, our government knows how to communicate with the experts. They have embedded expertise, so that's our job, to make sure government is full of AI expertise. And then regulatorily, we need to assess certain risks out there and do our best to regulate those risks. And I don't think in the main that will require passage of many new laws. I think we have long-standing laws pertaining to privacy rights, civil rights, consumer protection, for example, and those need to be applied to an AI-enabled world. So those values, which inform those earlier bodies of law, will have to be adapted and sometimes improved through drafting of new regulations. There will be some gaps to be filled, so to speak, and that will require legislating on an ongoing basis in what I think will be a really dynamic world with lots of AI development that will lead to things, threats, opportunities that are hard to predict. This is going to require a lot of committee-by-committee oversight, something we haven't done well in recent years. So from a congressional standpoint, I think we need to always be asking how we can be helpful and what we may be missing in our own jurisdiction.
So, Senator Warner, there's a new report out this morning, actually, from the White House that says that 10% of jobs will be immediately at risk from, or I should not say immediately, at risk from artificial intelligence. There's other jobs that would be impacted as well. So from a economic perspective, from a societal perspective, how does Congress and the government protect people from AI?
Well, let's break that into a couple of different categories. First, you know, there are going to be jobs disrupted, and frankly, they are going to be higher value jobs than have been disrupted in past iterations. I think the general consensus is there will still be, at least for the immediate future, AI will be a tool used to enhance jobs rather than full elimination. But, you know, well, time will tell, and we're going to need.
So you're on the optimistic side.
I'm still relatively on the optimistic side around job creation. I do think there are huge concerns around the large language models about their ability to be manipulated. And I still think, I fear that things like cyber protections, there's such a race going on in building out these models at this moment. Are any of these platforms taking enough time to build in security at the front end? You know, the level of ability to do prompt injection or other abilities to kind of manipulate the model, we're so racing who's going to win that I'm not sure security has been built in enough. One area, frankly, and I've been working on this for some time from the Intel Committee side, because I think it is also a national security risk. The NVIDIA chips and the power that's going to be required. One area that's going to be growth, this is going to exponentially drive up our energy demands. And, you know, a normal utility has an average growth rate of about 0.5% a year. We're going to move to 3 to 3.5 to 4% growth just on the need for power. So one of the things I'm working with some of the AI companies is, because they're going to have this giant power consumption, is can we look at new sources? I'm a big advocate for small modular nukes, SMRs, because frankly, China and Russia are going around and trying to sign up nation states for 50-year contracts with their technology. A number of nations are interested in our technology, but they want to see us build some of these first. So one of the, I know I've gone off the job pitch here, but one of the areas there's going to be also that AI is going to drive a transformation, will be in the power generation sector. And again, I think that's an area where we can compete and be successful.
Back to the labor markets, I agree with Mark's assessment of on all counts, this will impact more likely, at least in the early stages, your higher, you know, wage, higher salary sort of white-collar worker as opposed to blue-collar worker, which has not been the case with previous waves of automation, of course, seeing as robotics is lagging behind the artificial intelligence, which will, in the future, sort of drive robotics. But I think that there are some things, incremental things, that we can do to help our economy, help people adjust. And one is to increase the amount of tax-free write-off you get for upskilling and reskilling people. We have to be sensitive to this dynamic. We've got to get a lot better at pre-K through 14, if I can say that, in integrating artificial intelligence into our curriculum, so people off-ramp right out of their regular schooling and understand how this stuff works and are very comfortable with AI. I think much of that will be natural because it will be wrapped into, you know, our social lives, our communication, but we can't assume that. So there are things we should be thinking about right now, and this is why it's so important for Congress to actually use the committee process, because there are too many things for Mark or I to, you know, unpack, and we're going to have to insist that the committees be utilized.
So I only have a few minutes left, and I have one question each for each of you. So I want to get both of them in.
Are you saying that you don't want our fulsome answers?
I'm just laying out the facts. Senator Warner, this week there was a hearing at the Supreme Court about social media. And you submitted a brief in that case. So can you talk about the importance of this case?
I hope you read this brief.
In a minute and 15 seconds.
All right. There were a series of conservative attorney generals that raised a case that was taken up by the Fifth Circuit that basically said, we do not even want any voluntary communication between the government and social media platforms. Which I think is crazy, that somehow any communication would turn into coercion. And I view this from the standpoint of where the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee, when we exposed the level of Russian interference in the 2016 elections, social media platform after social media platform said, please, if you're seeing misinformation on our platforms, share that information with us. If we see a series of Russian bots, Zuckerberg from Facebook particularly said, you know, we'll share it with you guys. That led us to, frankly, in 2020, I feel like we were better prepared for election security under President Trump, unfortunately, than we are right now under President Biden. Mm-hmm. Part of this due to
this is the
chilling,
short answer, right?
This is, yeah, the chilling effect. The chilling effect. Todd, stick with me, buddy. Don't worry. We're the Senate. We can go over this minute and that 10 seconds. But hear me out. The fact is, there until a week or two ago, and I think the Supreme Court realized that this is not going to hold.
I'm at the end of the day, so I get 14 seconds.
The Supreme Court was holding back, but we had not had voluntary communications from July until January. And I think that is, we're not talking about coercion, we're talking about voluntary communications. And as we go into an era with AI tools and a lot of Americans concerned about security or not willing to believe anything in terms of conspiracy theory, and the fact that our adversaries know that interfering in our elections is cheaper than buying aircraft carriers, I think this is a case that I hope the Supreme Court will act on quickly.
Good job. That was a hard question
for lightning round. Right,
yeah.
For lightning round.
I didn't say it was lightning round.
I'll will my extra 60 seconds of overtime to Todd.
Look,
it's
look,
like the, it's
14,
like,
14.
Come on, take a little more time. Go work. Right.
It's like a Senate vote. A 15-minute vote takes 3.5 hours.
Oh, yeah. We would be willing to cut those off.
Senator Young, I want to talk to you about the CHIPS legislation. That is something that you were a big part of. Do you think 1.5 years later that it has been enough investment in the domestic manufacturing of chips in this country?
I do. I think it's enough to take a lot of the risk out of the supply chain, which was the goal. That was really the goal, is to de-risk our semiconductor supply chain. That goal is being accomplished. It's being accomplished because the administration, through Gina Raimondo's excellent leadership, has been very careful about how that $52 billion, which is a lot of money, but you start to look at how capital intensive the semiconductor industry is, and it seems like less money than it really is. And so she's been very careful about making targeted investments and driving tough bargains with her counterparties. That said, if we want to take more risk out of the supply chain, we could invest more money in this CHIPS project. And there have been some proposals to do that. I am, to be clear, not proposing that to my Republican colleagues out there who it took a lot of work to get them to a spot where they were comfortable recognizing that maybe the laws of supply and demand weren't really going to work in this situation sort of rapid basis without offering this incentive. The other thing I would say is the objective of CHIPS and Science was to learn how to make chips again, which sounds pretty fundamental. It is, and it's essential to our national security, not just our economic security. So we're learning how to make chips, and that will inform how we make the chips so that we can make trusted chips here in the United States that go into our weapons platforms.
That was a 14-second Senate answer.
Perfect. I only have 17 more questions that I didn't get to, yeah. But we're out of time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you both so much for joining
us.
I appreciate it.
Good job. Oh, yeah.
Hi, I'm Lori Montgomery. I'm the business editor here at the Washington Post. And today I'm going to be joined, virtually at least, by Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger. Welcome back to Washington Post Live, Pat.
Hey, thank you, Lori. Great to be joining you.
So yesterday was a pretty big day for you.
It was. It's not every day I get to host the Secretary of Commerce and the President at a major set of grants announcements at our construction site. It was quite the marvelous day in Arizona.
You got to spend quite a bit of time with the President. What did he want to talk about?
Well, he was pretty excited about, really the implications that the CHIPS Act is having to rebuild the supply chains. And of course, you know, with the president there, it's, the middle class and, the workers that we're bringing in to construct the fabs and then put it to work. So a lot of enthusiasm from him in that regard and just sort of the magic of silicon. And I get to geek out a little bit with the president. So he's let's say he's not ready to be a semiconductor designer, but he sure loves what we do.
So Intel has received the largest subsidy so far from the CHIPS Act, nearly $20 billion in grants and loans to support chip production as part of Biden administration's push to bring back high-tech manufacturing in America. Could you talk a bit about what this money will mean for Intel and for the homegrown chips manufacturing industry in general?
Yeah. And generally, it's like, why is this so important? And as I describe it, Lori, over 30 years, right, we've seen this industry and the manufacturing of chips move to Asia, right? And I say there never was a vote to get rid of this industry, but there were votes to attain this industry, throughout the Asian countries. And over time, the economics have made it untenable for us to be competitive in the U.S. market. So everything about the CHIPS Act, our $8.5 billion of grants, the $11 billion of loans, additionally, the 25%+ of tax credits that we get, almost $50 billion of the total package that we announced. And that allows us to be competitive. We of course have to produce the best technology, and I've been driving the company to get back to technology leadership, but it has to also be economic. And for this, we see ourselves now competitive with the Asian alternatives and a lot of enthusiasm and support to build resilient supply chains for the world. And everybody saw how fragile we had become through COVID. All of a sudden, it's like, oh my gosh, all of Detroit stopped because of semiconductor supply. We need balanced, resilient, sustainable, and trusted supply chains to both help the economy as well as to ensure our national security. So yesterday's announcement was a huge step forward to deliver on the promise of the CHIPS Act, the will of Congress, the support of the president and the administration, and literally of the nation, a very popular set of steps. And I think the most important piece of industrial policy since World War II.
So when will we begin to see the fruits of all this investment? The president has said that he's like to see 20% of advanced chips manufacturing back on U.S. shores by the end of the decade. Is that going to happen?
Well, my goal is a little bit higher than his. So he was happy, you know, I'm pushing to 50% in U.S. and Europe, which would mean more like 30% in the U.S. So I'm even a little bit more aggressive than that. But, you know, we're starting to produce things out of our New Mexico packaging facility. You know, we announced that just before the end of last year. The Arizona site that we were at yesterday, that will come online in 2025. You know, we expect some of the key Oregon technologies to start producing in 2025 and 2026. And then Arizona is 27, 28 when it comes on. I mean, Ohio is 27 and 28 when that starts ramping up. And as I described yesterday, the Silicon Heartland in Ohio, the Silicon Mesa in New Mexico, the Silicon Desert in Arizona, and the Silicon Forest in Oregon, all of these come to life as we go through the rest of the decade and really help to build that resilient supply chain, technology leadership for the future, and really the economic and national security benefits thereof are enormous.
At the same time, it seems like we've already hit some snags, though. You've announced some delays in Ohio. Which one is that? That's the Silicon Heartland, right?
There we go, yeah.
And there are also reports that Intel suppliers are delaying their supply chains to the U.S. due to higher than expected costs of operation. How are we to be sure that this will be on track in the time we need it to happen, and then it will be resilient and will succeed?
Yeah. And, you know, we've gone through a pretty harsh economic cycle, and the semiconductor industry has even, you know, been hit a bit harder by that. So this is to me, you know, the normal ebb and flow of the semiconductor market, where we have, you know, periods of extraordinary acceleration and cutbacks. But when you're looking at a 5-year capital build to bring these factories online, you can't judge that on quarterly ups and downs. So our Ohio facility is still within the range when we originally announced it. And if you go to Columbus, you know, there's an awful lot. We have thousands of construction workers on the site today. You know, we are underway. And we do need the supply chain. And this is something I spent considerable time yesterday with the president and Secretary Raimondo, that chips is a start. You know, it took us over 3 decades to lose this industry. We're not just fixing it in one bill in 3 or 4 years. We need sustained effort to rebuild that supply chain so that we get a positive cycle to our ecosystem as we close the cost gap, we build more momentum here. And that is sort of the next step to me. You know, CHIPS 2 is required to help reshore all of the supply chain. And I thought the president's comment yesterday was very apropos. He said, we don't want supply chains to end in the U.S. We want them to start and end in the U.S. And I think that's, you know, the objective that I would agree and have in mind.
I'll bet he was, like, pushing you on timing, though, right?
Oh, of course. Of course he was for it. And he wants it bigger. He wants it sooner. And I'll tell you, we are working at double time here to, you know, execute on this. And I'm really thrilled. And this was bipartisan as well. And the CHIPS Act was very well supported. You know, when I was at the State of the Union, there was only 2 topics that received unanimous support, bipartisan and, you know, bicameral support, and that was Ukraine and the CHIPS Act. I mean, this is super important to the nation, every aspect of your life. And I always like to ask Lori, you know, what aspect of your life is not becoming more digital? Well, everything is, and everything digital needs semiconductors. This is more important than where oil reserves are for the next 50 years. So let's build them where we want them. Let's own this technology. We invented it, and we are on a mission to restore these supply chains technology because it's that important to our future.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially the building blocks of modern life, right? But nonetheless, you know, there's huge demand for chips right now, and Intel is such a big profitable company. You know, people might be wondering, why do you need the government to subsidize it? Wouldn't you have made these investments on your own?
Well, if we were just following, you know, the financial model that is in the industry today, we'd build these in Asia because it's more cost competitive to be there. But that's the problem that we're out to fix, right? If I build all of my factories in Asia, okay, we've just become more dependent on global supply chains. And, you know, to me, all everything about the CHIPS Act was to solve this imbalance that led to 30 years of migration of this industry to Asia. And if there wasn't, you know, an economic jolt to say, yes, we are going to make long-term capital investments. We're going to make long-term tax policy adjustments. We are going to close that cost gap. So when I'm putting $30 billion into a factory like Ohio, it's economic. And if it's uneconomic, my shareholders say, why are you doing that? You know, go to a place and make good economic decisions associated with it. That's what we're doing with the CHIPS Act. This is not a handout. This is industrial policy to rebuild an essential industry in the United States. And I'm very proud to have played a part in that.
Well, that's a great entree into the question of how we did get here. Intel is a storied American company, been on the forefront of chip manufacturing for decades, including for much of your first 30 years with the company. But when you rejoined as CEO in 2021, the company was struggling. And, you know, what did go wrong? How did we fall so far behind, not just Intel, but chips manufacturing as a whole?
Yeah, and as I like to say, there was never a vote in Congress to get rid of this industry, but there were votes in China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan to subsidize significantly the attraction of this industry into Asia. And if you look at Chip War by Chris Miller, you know, he chronologizes literally over three decades of decided industrial policy in Asia to attract this industry. And if you keep at something that's important and you get good at it for three decades, okay, it's going to make a difference. So as I say, that was industrial policy at scale across Asia, and it was hugely successful. In contrast, none of our policies in the U.S. encourage long-term capital investments. We're on quarterly profit cycles. You know, get rid of that low-end manufacturing crap. We don't want to do that kind of work. We just want high-end software and other things like that. You know, and if you're only measured on a 90-day shot clock, that's what you get. So I do believe that there's fundamental rethinking required for these long industrial capital investment cycles and making sure our financial and, you know, industrial policies support the R&D. And clearly, Intel stumbled. You know, we had multiple generations of non-technical leaders, you know, that didn't have this, you know, vision of manufacturing and product innovation and what was required. And when I came back to the company, you know, it was, I told the board of directors and said, if you hire me for the job, you're doing two things. You're both picking me, but also agreeing on this strategy. And the strategy is an expensive one. We tripled, quadrupled the amount of yearly capital we're putting at play. To do that, you know, we're taking the company through a tough financial cycle that is not rewarded by Wall Street. You know, we're gonna make the long-term commitments required as we rebuild both our manufacturing capabilities and our technology leadership. And we're well underway. 3 years into the journey, this is happening. Obviously, the CHIPS Act, you know, is helping to rebuild this industry in the U.S., benefiting us, but also benefiting the entire industry. And others will be receiving grants as well to help rebuild. But this is just the beginning. I do believe we're going to need a CHIPS too, right? You can't fix in 1 3-year legislation over three decades of bad decisions. So I think there will be more required, but this to me is a fabulous start, a proud day for U.S., for our industry, and for Intel.
I want to turn to the effects of the AI boom, but real quickly, how much more do you think we'll need to invest in this? What does a CHIPS 2 look like, and what are you telling Washington about that?
Well, I think CHIPS 2, and if you look at CHIPS 1, you know, there's grants, there's tax incentives, there's R&D requirements associated with it. To me, CHIPS 2 needs to be some level of grants, more focus on sustainable tax policy, you know, and capital, you know, deductions for, or tax deductions for capital investments to me is good policy, period, because that really is a foreteller of future manufacturing capacity in America. I do think the R&D aspect, we just have to build an R&D capacity for decades to come. But the final thing of a CHIPS too, to me, is supply chain, right? Somewhat going back to one of your earlier questions, we need to build the ecosystem to create economic sustainability so that you don't have to keep coming back for government support. So to me, those would be the elements of a CHIPS too, as I believe it will be required. However, to me, the best thing to do for CHIPS 2 is make CHIPS 1 successful. And we have to prove that this was a great piece of industrial policy legislation, and success breeds success. And yesterday was a big step to make CHIPS 1 successful.
So you're not going to give us a dollar figure for CHIPS 2?
Not today.
All right. Shifting to AI, the boom in generative AI has transformed the semiconductor landscape. Advanced chips are essential to train and run AI programs, and much of Silicon Valley seems to be engaged in a mad scramble for GPUs these days. Sam Altman at OpenAI is reportedly trying to raise as much as $7 trillion, trillion with a T, to build new chip factories and sources of energy. Have you talked to Sam about this? Is Intel interested?
Well, I've had numerous conversations with Sam on the subject. And in fact, at one of our events about 3 weeks ago, Intel Direct Connect, when we sort of opened the doors of our foundry and ecosystem partnerships, Sam joined me on stage for a conversation. And guess what the first question was I asked him? Hey, Sam, what's this $7 trillion about? So it's online. You can go to our website and take a look at the interview I had, you know, with Sam. And that covers data centers, power, but also semiconductors. Because, you know, if you believe, you know, what Sam and others are saying, you know, we don't need 10 times more computing power. You know, we need 10,000 times more computing power to accomplish this area of, right, artificial general intelligence. And I think most would, you know, believe that that be, would be the case. And that's putting, you know, pressure on us going faster. And we don't just think about it as the big training systems in the cloud, but how every enterprise data center becomes AI enabled, how every edge environment becomes AI enabled, and how every personal computer becomes AI enabled. So we see this as, you know, an accelerant to the overall growth of the semiconductor industry. And, you know, with that, you know, hey, I do think this is going to require capital. This is going to, you know, expand the fab investments. I described Ohio yesterday, the Silicon Heartland, as the AI Silicon Heartland. You know, I think a lot of the manufacturing for these AI chips will happen right there in Ohio. You know, that said, hey, this is still, you know, a very speculative area. What is the chips? What are the algorithms? You know, how's this going to, you know, play out over time? You know, we're still in the first inning of what AI architectures are going to look like. So a lot of innovation in front of us, a lot of speculation. But Sam, I hope to have many, right, of his algorithms running in the chips that we manufacturing and what we announced yesterday.
So I'm told this might have to be our last question, but at the moment, a couple of other companies are pretty far ahead of Intel in terms of capitalizing on the AI boom. NVIDIA is designing the chips, TSMC is manufacturing the chips. Can Intel catch up, and how?
We certainly believe so. You know, part of this is the continuing build of us getting back to leadership. And, you know, TSMC has been a great foundry for the industry. But we believe that fundamentally there's only two companies in the world, Intel and TSMC, that will be able to manufacture, you know, these leading edge technologies. Many of our packaging technologies are now getting widely recognized as the best choice for AI chips in the future, and a bit of an on-ramp for us being the manufacturing partner for engaging in many of the AI chip projects of tomorrow. So we have to rebuild our technology. We have to build the manufacturing capacity. We have to win these customers onto our factory. As I said with Gina Raimondo yesterday, she now has sales targets from me, right, to get these customers favoring US. And fundamentally, you know, we have a big tailwind behind us. The world wants geographically balanced, resilient supply chains. You know, many of these chips today are produced in, you know, tenuous locations in the world. You know, so there's a lot of enthusiasm to have an alternative supplier for that. And our chips are getting better. you know, we're starting to show up with some very competitive chips ourselves. So I say that 100% of the AI TAM is available to Intel through my products and through my foundry. And we expect that that becomes a tailwind for us as we go through, you know, the decade, building on what we announced yesterday.
All right. Well, we'll wish you luck and leave it there. Pat Gelsinger, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lori. Look forward to having a great time.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats, BEETS.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.